I certainly shall. Fool smiled tightly.
Then what is the concern here, Mr. Barr?
It is a question of when, sir. What manner of project?
Profitable ones.
Barr licked at his lower lip. A thick, blunt tongue, white as a grub.
I shall need more than that, Mr. Fool, if you wish to appease my associates. What sort of return are you expecting?
You'll have your money, Mr. Barr, Fool said again. Molly chewed at her nails, leaned over, spat into the carpet. Flood's low voice rumbled from the shadows.
That ain't the way to ask for it now, is it?
He said, his huge strangler hands open on the table. Barr looked unimpressed.
Mr. Flood, I presume?
Mr. Flood, Fool said, gesturing wearily. Mr. Barr. Mr. Barr is a business associate of ours.
An investor, Barr corrected, who has yet to see a return on his investment.
Some prospects is just a losing proposition, Flood grunted. Sometimes you just cut your losses like.
Mr. Barr's prospects do not lose, Fool said. Do they, sir?
They do not.
Flood turned his shaggy face towards Fool, raised his eyebrows.
You'll have your return, Mr. Barr, Fool said quickly. He wanted to avoid further provocation. I assure you of that. But I do need a little more time.
You are out of time, sir.
Another few weeks. My reputation as an earner is worth that much, surely.
It used to be so.
A jack can't pay what he can't pay, Molly muttered.
Barr sat with his oily face calm and he ran a finger over his hair, smoothing it. He said,
Ah, child, but there are many ways to make up what is owed.
Are there not, Mr. Fool?
Fool frowned.
Next time, sir, it will not be me coming to visit,
Barr said with a shrug. He pinched up the fabric at his knees.
And it ain't like to be Mr. Fool they find waitin', Flood growled.
Barr nodded coolly, a flicker of a smile at his lips.
Mr. Fool, Mr. Flood, he said, rising from his chair.
He set his hat delicately on his head, screwed it into place. At the door, he paused.
Might I recommend the 72 Chateau, an excellent companion to the salmon?
And then the door closed, and Fool sighed, rubbing his temples with two fingers.
Just how much you in the bag for?
Flood said, as soon as the man was gone.
Oh, we're all ears, Adam,
Molly said. She sat in the chair Barr had been using and wriggled on her haunches.
It's all bloody warm now, like sitting down in his lap it is.
Cork it, kid, Flood said. You're the one what brought the bugger.
Molly was making a show of standing, draping her coat over Barr's seat.
It's only business, Japheth,
Fool said. It'll be settled soon enough. Mr. Barr is a useful man to know. Maybe the cleanest fence in the flash.
I'd regret offending him unduly.
Then you best pay him.
We'll need the funds first.
Fool tried to smile but did not quite manage it. We've been shifting stock through Mr. Barr since 82. He's floated us a few times when he needn't have. He has his own pressures, I'm sure. This visit wasn't much more than a gentle nudge.
Fool could hear the roar of the flash house below.
I think Mr. Barr looks on us with a rather friendly eye, he said.
Flood grunted, eyes glistening in the candle fire like the head of twin nails. Molly looked up, met Fool's gaze, and there was in her face some troubled thing. She dragged the shoe over the carpet, back and forth.
What is it, Molly?
She shook her head.
Nothing. I was just thinking. You should find that mudlark.
Flood raised his face in surprise, studied Fool. Seeing the girl's expression cloud over, Fool thought of her that night after Sharper's, in the carriage, as they rode slowly back towards Half Moon Street. How she had laid her head on his shoulder, the light warmth of her curled there, her soft breathing. For days now, he had glimpsed her standing at the Emporium windows, lost in thought, and had understood, grievously,
what had been stirred up in her from that visit. Fool had lost his own share of loved ones, but for Molly there was only the lost child, Peter, eaten by the outer darkness of London.
"Mrs. Sharper said Annie's down in the cubbies," Molly muttered. "If you think the grindbone's likely down in your Charlotte, it don't seem right not to go on after him. You don't want the not knowing, Adam. You want to feel like you've done all you could."
Fool nodded.
"I don't know as how you get down there and back out in one piece, but a dipper used to work the lay with me. Maybe knows something. Used to hole up down under Blackfriars in the winters. I can ask him if you like."
Fool felt Flood's eyes on him. He said softly, "We already have a man in mind."
"He ain't agreed to it as yet," Flood said.
Molly paused, studied them with her small eyes.
"Who is it?"
"Pinkerton."
"Pinkerton?"
"Aye, Pinkerton."
"You met with William Pinkerton?"
she said slowly. Fool nodded. He had thought she would be angry, but instead she only nodded and folded and unfolded her hands, solemn and thoughtful.
"We operated a long time without never attracting undue attention, Adam," she murmured. "You always said it were the best way to keep in the clear, not being noticed like."
She looked up, frowning.
"And now you bring in William Pinkerton. You can't mean to trust the bastard."
"Trust has nothing to do with it."
"But you'd send him down into the cubbies, on flash business."
"You want to go instead?"
"I ain't scared to."
She scratched angrily at her ear.
"We can always find some jack to go, Adam, but using Pinkerton in the risk?"
A faint downturn at the edges of her lips as she considered.
"What don't I see? Is there some role to it, Jappy?"
"It weren't me decision."
Fool rapped a patient knuckle on the arm of his chair.
"It's been decided, rightly or wrongly. It's a calculated risk." "Calculated me arse!"
Molly leaned across, picked a chunk of salmon from Fool's plate with her fingers.
"It's our bloody necks in the noose, too, that bastard ever gets a wind up. Then Pinkertons keep a record of every Jake in the flesh, and they share it out to the 4 and 10, Adam.
I don't believe we're in any danger."
"You don't believe it?" Molly muttered. "You send Pinkerton in, there's no knowing what will happen, or even if he's to come out of it in one piece. Those berserkers, they cut their own tongues out to stay quiet. A mole swap I known, she told me them berserkers keep hordes of rats, herd them like sheep."
She lowered her voice.
"I heard they eat people who get lost in there."
Flood loosened his collar.
"Maybe they'll eat Pinkerton and be done with it," he said.
He was 9 years old and standing at the great library windows watching the rain blow in sheets against the glass when he heard the maid in the hall cry out. The cry was terrible, forlorn. In the marble foyer he found the house servants gathered, hushed, none at work.
"She's dead,"
the cook told him, her voice breaking. She was clutching a letter.
"Poor Mrs. Shade is died, Master Edward, bless her soul."
Fool started to cry. The last time he had seen her, she had kneeled before him in the gravel drive of Shade House and kissed him farewell, and her lips had felt cold on his forehead. Then she had smoothed her skirts, adjusted an elaborate floral hat brim over her eyes. She was to travel to a hot springs in Colorado for the waters. A strange lightness came over him in the days following. He drifted on the edges of rooms, uncertain. He was noticed less and less and fed only intermittently. His governess packed her bag the second day and was gone. The cook did not attend to her duties after the fourth day. He and the boy James sat with their legs dangling through the railing posts on the second floor landing and watched the adults wander through the house, removing statuary, silverware, valuable books. On the sixth day, Fisk found him and told him no provision had been made for him in the will.
"The estate is to be divided among Mrs. Shade's relatives," he said curtly. "They will sail out here from Ireland in the new year. In the meantime, I am to close up the house and begin a stock-taking."
"Where will I go, sir?"
Fool had asked.
"You, Master Edward," Fisk had said, "shall be reacquainted with the real world, I should think."
He and the boy James were sent south by rail to Washington, D.C., They arrived cold and frightened and slept 2 days in the railroad depot with their little suitcases at their feet, watching the travellers striding past, dragging upturned crates across the floor in the hours between trains to pick through the garbage bins for food. On the third afternoon, a fruit seller took them to a police station for the constables to deal with. He could remember a sergeant walking through the cold dusk, and them climbing endless stairs in an apartment house, where carts rattled past every half hour, and where they were fed plate after plate of scrambled eggs and great thick hot slabs of ham. He remembered the shine of grease on James's lips. He had thought they might live there, but in the morning the sergeant returned them to the station as if they had done something wrong, and later that afternoon a nun arrived and took his friend away, holding the wrong suitcase in her enormous hand, and 2 hours later a very old priest in a black suit came for him. They had been separated as a matter of principle, and they would not ever see each other again. Fool wore his friend's baggy clothes for 6 months with the sleeves rolled back, and the waistlines ballooning under his fist before he at last gave up hope, and when he could no longer remember his friend's face, he traded the clothes for a box of marbles, and the suitcase itself, with James Gray in copperplate, for a pair of good leather shoes. He slept in that orphanage for 3 years, slept whether awake or no. The long chilly wards with their tiers of beds, the gangs of boys brutal in the dining hall, the quick illicit nature of their deceptions. He learned not to remember Mrs. Shade, Shade House, the kindnesses of a life now lost. There was anger in him, at first, that she, too, had died and abandoned him, but slowly that anger drained and left only emptiness. All was grey in his new home, the walls, jerseys, the skin on the backs of the nun's hands. The boys had been put to work stitching or repairing clothes, and the older ones would work in the woodshop in the basement, and all were beaten with hollow canes as a matter of course. At night they would move from bed to bed while the wardmaster snored in his enclave, and they would trade their goods, and whisper rumours of an easier world beyond the orphanage walls, a world of pickpockets and fine suits and easy women. Fool there learned that size did not equal power, and strength was sometimes weakness. He learned the trick to not getting caught lay in being among the unsuspected. He learned compassion by its lack. He learned blood by its plenty. Then one April morning in his 11th year, he stuffed his belongings into a pillowcase and walked out of the front gate of that orphanage with a boy named Cullen at his side. That boy took their few coins and all of their food and disappeared on the second night, and Fool never saw him again. He slept under bridges. He stole from street sellers. He begged and dealed and sold to pawn shops. He learned in time to steal pedigreed dogs from the finer houses and then return them for their rewards. He was twice beaten and once near raped, and those men he fled from with his shirt tails flapping, and shortly thereafter he made his slow way by road north to New York City. He was small for his age, but quick and savage with the razored instincts of a survivor, and it was not long before he found himself adopted into a gang of pickpockets and thieves. He learned the art of the lift, and they worked in teams of three under a master thief, and they kept only a small portion of their takings. His violet eyes were startling, but he had heavy, shaggy eyebrows that gave him a glower beyond his years, and his looks attracted notice in the daylight. He learned to prowl the night streets outside the theatres, and to slip between the carriages of the wealthy, and he would dream, as he did so, of one day walking among them undisguised. That was a world of grand dinners and fiery candelabra glimpsed through closing doors, and of fine white horses that would knock a street lad into the mud without slowing, and he loathed it and longed for it and lived in the shadow of it, learning his trade the while. He was 13 years old when the war broke out. There was a wildness in the streets, a reckless electricity in the crowds. In September of that year he lined up with several hundred others at the enlistment tents for the New York Light Artillery, hoping to acquire the signing bounty of $1,000. He had smudged his face and roughened his clothes in an attempt to look older, but the tired men around him in line jostled him and laughed at the disguise. It was raining, and the water tipped from the brim of his hat as he looked away. When Fool reached the front of the line, the enlistment sergeant was seated at a table under an awning, shuffling papers. The grass had been trampled to mud.
Name? The sergeant barked. Then he glanced up, paused. How old are you, son?
18, sir.
The sergeant frowned past Fool in his ragged coat at the lines of men in the rain. Someone snickered.
You want to fight for your country, son? The sergeant asked.
Fool thought of Mrs. Shade, buried somewhere in the western deserts. He thought of his father dying in a lodging house in Baltimore. Death was life. He said, in his roughest voice,
I want to kill the bastard enemy, sir.
The sergeant eyed him grimly up, scratched at his chin.
That's what I like to hear, he grunted. Welcome to the United States Army, son.
17. William left Blackwell at the gates of Millbank and drifted down to the embankment. He glared out at the river, seeing nothing in the orange light, and shaking his head as he did so. Reckitt had named Adam Fool, had named him. Whatever else, then, Fool was telling the truth about having once been a part of the Reckitt's world. It did not mean that Fool's account of the killing of Shade was true, nor did it mean Fool's clue about the mudlark was to be trusted. He frowned out at the river. But Shore had heard of the Saracen. That killer was real. William thought of the sewer lines and the berserkers prowling them, and the likelihood of finding a solitary mudlark, long ago eaten by the city's darkness, and of finding her alive. There was just enough truth in the man Fool's accounts to make something possible. Just enough truth, he scowled, to make a dangerous lie. He started to walk towards Whitehall, hesitated, his breath clouding the cold air. The brown waters of the Thames muscling past, the city rooftops millionfold in the haze beyond. His mind kept returning to that one undeniable fact. The old thief had named Adam Fool.
Go on, then, he muttered. What are you waiting for? Go seek out your mudlark.
He smiled all at once at his heart's delusions.
But take the man Fool when you do.
Margaret Ashling would be a mystery to him his entire life. He thought their happiness unlikely, chanced, as all happiness must seem in retrospect. After 20 years he still held her chair out for her at dinner, with a wonder tilting inside him that she had chosen him, had married him. He would watch her from bed as she sat at the vanity and combed her long hair, 70 strokes each night, and he would not speak, only listen to her breathe, knowing that nothing in his life would be as beautiful or as complicated as the silences between them. It astonished him how young they had once been. He had loved her name from the first, the aristocratic lace of its syllables, the knots it made of his tongue.
Margaret, he had murmured, staring in his pyjamas into the looking-glass at Notre Dame, then blushing and rinsing his mouth at the unmanliness of it, and hoping the other boys had not heard.
But he could not help himself.
Margaret Ashling, a name he could lean into, a name to keep pace by.
She was 2 years his junior and small, but there was something in her that made him feel foolish, brash, like a dulled knife, and he mooned over her during his classes and while playing rugby and cricket in the autumn evenings. He never did learn to predict her reactions. She would prove calm and then furious, patient and then stubborn. She would break upon him like a wave and leave him staggering, and then just as quickly stop and apologize, and the rage in her would snuff itself out.
I feel I hardly know you, he whispered to her in the 3rd month of their courtship, standing at the edge of a frozen pond while their friends skated past.
He brushed her wrist with his glove. Her cheeks were red in the cold.
Because you don't, she said, and bit her lip. Not yet.
Scotland Yard felt big and empty at midday, although there lingered a waft of night dirt in the halls from the full pails. He passed no one on the stairs, and when he reached Shaw's office, the chief inspector was not in. William tried the door and was surprised when it opened. A weak daylight was coming in through the coal-grimed windows, and he let his eyes adjust before closing the door behind him. It was then he felt a movement at the edge of his vision, a sort of slow unfolding in the dimness, and when he glanced across, He saw the long, thin figure of Dr. Breck behind Shaw's desk. He was in the process of closing a drawer.
"I guess John doesn't mind you sitting there," William said.
Breck shrugged curtly.
"I wondered if he would send for you."
But he had not been sent for. Neither Shaw nor Blackwell had informed them of a meeting. True, he was not present on official duty, and perhaps, if he was sure, he would not bring a man like himself into an investigation either. He thought this, and then he scowled at the idiocy of it. No, he would use a man of ability, rules be damned. He thought of Martin Reckitt's account of Shaw as a bullying child, and what Blackwell had told him about his personal antipathy towards Reckitt, and then he grimaced at the murkiness of it all. But in their world, everyone was tainted, eventually. He glowered, looked up. "You have some results?" Breck ran his hand along the leather armrest of the chair, a smooth, eerie gesture.
"Did you know, Mr. Pinkerton, there are doors in the Queen's treasury covered in human skin? A colleague of mine at the Royal College of Surgeons was showing them to me. Most interesting. Made from the skin of William the Sacrist."
William removed his gloves and set them in his upturned hat.
"A saint? A thief. Notorious in the 13th century. He stole the royal treasury and hid it in a bog before vanishing away."
"Not quite vanishing." William sat, the leather crinkling under his weight. A sound of muffled voices from the hallway, approaching the office. The door opened and Shaw came through, Blackwell in tow. William twisted in his seat, but seeing the chief inspector's eyes, something caught in William, some flare of caution. Shaw grunted.
"I won't ask what you're doing here. I came to see you."
He gave a sharp, resigned shrug of his shoulders, not waiting for a reply, and his black mood seemed to ease.
"Well, you might as well stay and hear Dr. Breck out."
He crossed to the light stand, the office filled with a soft yellow glow.
"How did it go at Millbank? Did good Mr. Reckitt give up anything of use?"
"Nothing.
Not even to the great American defective?"
Breck gave a strange, high-pitched chuckle. William shifted in his chair so he could see the two men better.
"Millbank was," he cleared his throat, "interesting. Reckitt hadn't heard about his niece. How did he take it? How do you think?"
Shaw struggled irritably out of his coat, sat at his desk.
"Cat's out of the bag now, I reckon. Should I not have said?"
Shaw unfastened his cuffs and shoved his sleeves up his forearms as if he were about to reach into a wash basin.
"Doesn't matter," he said,
but there was in his gesture a kind of furtiveness. William watched him, wondering if Blackwell's insinuations and Martin Reckitt's allusions had muddied his own sense of the man.
"And what about you, Doctor?" Shaw said. "What did you bring me? Something useful, I trust?"
Breck wiped at his lips with a handkerchief.
"Forensically speaking, in plain English, please."
Breck looked from Shaw to William a moment, and there was in it a kind of complicity. He said,
"The hair from the legs is dark at the roots."
He took up a slide and held it to the light, and then passed it across to Shaw.
"At its ends you will see the colouring to be much paler, nearly grey in its discoloration, even. Upon examination, my assistant detected minuscule traces of sand, sawdust and coal."
Shaw set the slide down with a soft click on the table.
"Coal," he murmured. "Anthracite, to be exact. The sand is more interesting. We found no trace of it in the sacking. It consists of silicate, ferruginous silicate, and quartz. When we split the sawdust with a microtome, it turned out to consist of pine and oak." "You can tell all of this," William said, amazed.
Breck unhooked his spectacles and held them down before his face, as if to peer at the lenses before continuing.
"The stains on the inside of the sacking that held the legs are also from anthracite, intermingled with traces of mildew," he said. "All of this could indicate a location from which the sacking originated. The sand might offer a possibility as to where the legs were kept prior to being wrapped up."
"I'd like to take this fellow back with me to Chicago,"
William said with a slow smile. He looked from Shaw to Blackwell with his eyebrows raised, and then back at Shaw.
"I think Mrs. Breck might object to that, sir,"
Blackwell said. Shaw grinned.
"She might not."
"There's a Mrs. Breck,"
William said. The doctor rose and limped across to the coat rack and took from the pocket of his topcoat a second collodion slide. He said, "The three small insects found on the inner fold of the sacking from Southwark Park are anophthalmi, a species of blind beetle. They are quite colourless, quite devoid of pigment."
"Are they from the park?"
"No."
"Blind,"
murmured Blackwell.
"So they come from under the earth, sir?"
"From the dark, to be exact. Taken together with the other fragments, it would not seem unlikely that the body was kept for a time in a cellar. I might suggest a vault."
"Except for the sawdust,"
William said.
"Correct."
"It would seem our killer has gone to ground,"
Blackwell said.
Shaw gave him an exasperated look.
"Is there anything more?" William said.
"Anything from the torso to help?"
"Indeed. The skin was covered with Saccharomyces cerevisiae, a bacterium, used in the fermenting of alcohol." Shaw was rubbing at his face, the cords in his thick forearms cabling under the skin.
"The sawdust suggests this cellar must also hold firewood, or perhaps even be used for sawing it."
"It's a pub,"
Blackwell said suddenly.
"Aye. This will be a popular assignment,"
William said with a wry smile. He crossed to the far wall and studied the big city map. He drew a line from Edgware Road down to Southwark Park and stood staring at the Thames in between. "What about the locations of the drops?" he said. "The torso was found on Edgware Road. That was in the early hours of the morning. The labourers wouldn't have been on site until when? 6 o'clock?
4:30, sir,"
said Blackwell. William nodded. "That leaves very little time. Whoever did this acted fast. That means they were decisive, did not hesitate. The torso was probably deposited first. The head was collected at the docks, which means it was dropped upriver from there. It was collected by a lighter man at work. How long would it take such an item to drift downstream from the bridges?"
"It was caught in a mooring cable, sir,"
said Blackwell.
"It could have been there for days."
"But Charlotte Rackett only disappeared the night before. How is that possible?"
"Maybe it isn't Charlotte Rackett."
"Facts," Shaw said. "Let us work with the facts, gentlemen."
"What about the state of decay?" William asked. "Can we tell anything about how long the head was in the water?" Breck clasped his hands behind his back. The three men waited. The doctor said nothing. Shaw cleared his throat.
"Doctor?"
Breck gave him a slow look with his watery blue gaze.
"Less than 3 days,"
he said reluctantly. "Perhaps not even one." William turned back to the line on the map. "The Thames I can understand," he said. "From any bridge, the head could be dropped rather easily. But the torso would be heavy and bulky. The legs, too. Why would the killer distribute them so far apart? He would have had to carry at least one of the packages some distance from the scene of the killing. Perhaps both. Why go to such trouble? And if he were going to such trouble, why not dump both at the same time, in the same location?"
"Edgware Road is a short walk from the end of the number 11 omnibus route, sir,"
Blackwell said.
"You're not suggesting the bastard carried the torso on an omnibus, Inspector?"
"At that hour, would a hansom not make more sense?" William said.
"It would certainly draw less attention,"
Shaw said.
"But?"
The chief inspector frowned.
"But that would mean two things. The driver, first. Somewhere there is a witness to this parcel being picked up."
William interrupted. "Not only picked up."
"What do you mean?"
"Not only picked up," he said again. "What would have struck the driver as odd would have been the dropping off. A big package like that, at a strange hour of the night, in the middle of a deserted construction site."
"What if it wasn't obvious? The package might look like construction supplies. In the middle of the night?"
"Aye," said Shaw,
"and our killer would have risked being seen."
Blackwell cleared his throat.
"What if it was a private carriage, sir?"
Shaw looked disgusted.
A gentleman of standing would never be involved in something like this. I've been an inspector 15 years. I've never seen such a thing. William shrugged. Where I come from, it's the more likely. We're not in America. So you keep reminding me. Shaw was shaking his head. What about Southwark Park? Is there any link between there and the building site? The omnibus route, sir. The number 11 changes to the number 3 during the week. The number 3 runs into Southwark, sir. William regarded Blackwell, feeling something almost like admiration. How do you know so much about this, Blackwell?
My brother, sir. He was a cad in an omni over Blackfriars.
Are we talking about the same omnibus for each route? Blackwell shook his head.
Hard to say, sir. On a private route, the driver can change over at his leisure.
Pubs, William said abruptly. If they're fermenting in their cellars, wouldn't they have access to a horse and wagon?
Aye.
So we might have just a delivery wagon being used here then. Shaw stood and crossed to the window and there folded his ruddy arms. We keep it simple, he said. We know we want a pub with a cellar. It should be somewhere near the Thames, and we suspect we want a pub with a delivery wagon. The cellar should hold coal and firewood.
What about the omni routes?
Leave those for now. Start by asking at Edgware and Southwark if any carriages or wagons were noticed in the area around the suspected hours. We're talking about some rather large and heavy items. It shouldn't be hard to find a witness noticing something. Dr. Brick, can you have a sketch drawn up of the woman as she must have been in life?
I can arrange that.
Shaw nodded. Inspector, you take the drawing from pub to pub and make inquiries. Do not reveal that she is dead. Say something else. Say we are looking for her on behalf of, I don't know, a relative. Perhaps an unexpected inheritance. See if anyone recognizes her.
Yes, sir.
There's a limited number of places in London that will fit with the good doctor's findings. We just need to be thorough. Blackwell cleared his throat.
We might put out a reward, sir, he said. In the interests of being thorough, sir.
You disapprove, Mr. Pinkerton? Breck asked, his eyes alight. William grunted. He had been frowning at Blackwell in distaste.
Our agency never posts them, he said slowly. Our operatives never accept them.
Shaw bared the pink of gums in a grin, and there was in it, William thought, something unsavory.
Aye. Your father used to refuse them as a policy.
And I can tell you why, William said. We had a case in Chicago a few years back, before the Telegraph had made much impact. The leaks had just been opened. The city was something of a boomtown in those days. My father had given me this case to work. It was the murder of a local bar owner's wife, found bludgeoned to death outside the locked doors of his residence. They were wealthy, prominent. Some thought it was a political killing. He had evidently been involved in passing an ordinance that affected the hiring of non-local labor, something to do with immigrants and lower wages. Of course, the police couldn't find any motive. I was brought into the investigation late. The evidence was poor. The witnesses already worked over. I didn't know what else to do. The bar owner insisted on posting a reward. $100. The police matched it. I allowed it. I went to the newspapers with the offer. And? And the killer himself came forward. Turned himself in. He was a vagrant. He'd been out of work for some time. Had a wife with a child on the way. But he claimed the reward, and we could see no legal reason not to give it to him. He gave it to his wife to provide for the child. The law allowed for it. The law allowed for it. I asked him after his sentencing. He was to be hanged before the week was out. Why he'd killed the woman. He told me he'd trusted a reward would be posted if the murder were careful enough. He told me he knew he could not provide for the child. He asked me how much a life was worth, and what was a father's life worth if he could not keep his baby alive. The men were silent. The light shifted in the window.
I believe, Shaw murmured, we are in no danger of that here.
If you post a reward, John, we both know the public will flood you with tips. Even if you only look into the useful ones, you'll be busy for weeks following up.
We might find something of use, sir,
Blackwell said to Shaw. You'll find something of use by good detective work and careful thinking and a compliant public. not by wasting your time on gossip and hearsay. William looked at Shaw. Let me ask you this. What would Charlotte Reckitt be doing in a pub cellar with her hair cut short, drugged and tied up?
You make it sound like she was there by choice, Shaw said. Charlotte Reckitt had plenty of bad credit with plenty of flash folk, not to mention her uncle. We'll check the flash houses first.
William clicked his pocket watch open, clicked it shut.
You should get yourself some rest, William. You don't look well.
William rubbed at his eyes with the heels of his hands.
I know what I look like, he said.
It was in 1862, in a ramshackle military hospital outside Antietam, that William woke feverish and in pain, and saw Margaret at his bedside, and understood their life to come. They would be wed after the war, and he would not leave her again for the rest of his days. But nor would he live them alongside her. Theirs would be a marriage of leave-takings and returnings, a marriage forged in railroad stations and dusty traveling satchels and late envelopes and unwritten recriminations. He could not be other than he was. He understood his entire life he would seek out death, and sidle up next to it, and set a powerful hand on its shoulder and pin its arm into the small of its back, and he would do this in the Ozarks, in the Black Hills of Dakota, in the warehouses of the New York waterfront, any place he was called on to act, on trains moving at speed through mountain passes and at poker tables on paddle wheelers in the Mississippi and galloping bareback down dirt roads outside New Orleans. He awoke in that military hospital with his left knee swaddled and the pain rising in waves through his body, so that he would tense and flinch and ease and tense again for hours on end, while the boys around him cried or moaned or lay staring at stumps where 2 days earlier arms had been. And he watched Margaret wend her way down past the other cots and come to him wearing a stained white dress, and he felt the luckiest of all those lucky enough to be alive. She had journeyed all night on special trains under a warrant issued by his father, and had come to him at that hospital to bring him back from the war. She had just turned 15 years old and was taller than when he had seen her last, and her eyes were no longer the eyes of a girl. Seeing her, he understood death would not take him. He already belonged to her. He was 16 years old then, and not yet shaving, but when he reached for her hand, his own hand shook like the hand of an old man. He slept out the afternoon, deep into evening. Outside the hotel, the sprung hansom bowed and rocked as he climbed in, as the wheels jounced into motion. The sheen of sweat on Vermeer's hindquarters smoldered in the cold air. At the bottom of Regent Street, he stepped down and put on his hat and stared out at the deserted gloom of Waterloo Place. The driver gave him a questioning look, but said nothing, and then snapped the reins and went on. William crossed the vacant square with his gloved hands loose at his sides, his shoes loud on the cobblestones, made his way past a statue of a robed figure, laurels in its fists like snakes. At its base, 6 gas lamps burned weakly like globes of fruit on twisted iron stems, and a man in rags stood in their light, his bare hands on the wheel of an overturned barrow, his bewhiskered face upturned in rapture. He found the shop without trouble. It was set back from the square, a dark cobbled lane, bollards blocking the entrance. Gold lettering curlicued onto the glass. Gleason's Gunsmithing, Locksmithing, etc. A weak light burned within. He entered decisively and walked past implements and keys, tiny blades shivering on hooks as he went. A smell of oiled metal, wood shavings. In a corona of light behind the counter, a figure dipped and straightened over a sharpening box, feet paddling the grinder. It was a boy, 15, 16. He withdrew a long cleaver from its slot and set it carefully aside, and wiped his knuckles on his apron and approached. Narrow, vicious eyes, pimples in a burst of grease on his forehead. He caught William's eye and stopped short, out of reach, his left hand in shadow.
"We're closed, mister," he said. "You'd be best back in the morning. Mr. Gleason's not in the shop at this hour."
"Albert," he said. He could feel the size of himself there, the shadow he must be. The apprentice peered at him, hesitant.
"Do I know you?"
William lowered his chin so his hat brim would catch the lantern glow and bury his eyes in darkness. He said softly, the menace in it unmistakable,
"You are acquainted with Mr. Fool, Albert."
The apprentice cast an uneasy glance into the gloom.
"I have a message. I'll be passing through Waterloo Place tomorrow night. 10 o'clock. I want him to meet me there. Tell him I'll do as he asks, but not alone. See that Mr. Fool gets it."
The apprentice ran a black knuckle under his lip, as if gathering courage.
"And who do I say it's from, sir?"
But William had already turned and started back up the aisle, wrestling his gloves on as he went, and he did not bother to reply.
18.
Fool went, as instructed. A splatter of gaslight on the cobblestones, shadows clinging to the brick and mortar walls in the gloom. Fool could see nothing in Waterloo Place, no figure, only darkness and the statue like a twist of knuckled stone above its gas lamps. He did not call out. He walked slowly into the open, the chalky scrape of his stick loud on the cobbles, his scarf wrapped tight at his throat. He checked his pocket watch, 10:05. Then came a low huffing of breath at his back, and he turned sharply. And there the man was. He had been watching, of course. Thick-set, vengeful, he loomed up before Fool in the faint light, the vapoured heat of him rising yellow and eerie from his shoulders and coat. The curve of his top hat's shadow concealed his eyes. Then he stepped closer and lifted his face, and Fool watched the man's deep-set eyes scan the square.
"I've come quite alone, sir," Fool murmured. "I assure you."
Pinkerton seemed to glower down with a swift and mercurial fury, and then this too was gone. He said nothing until he had searched him, ran his hands along Fool's arms, under his armpits. He kneeled and felt firmly the length of his trouser legs. He got to his feet and unbuttoned Fool's topcoat, and ran a hand smoothly over the inner lining, and he withdrew from a waistcoat pocket a pocket watch, and then replaced it without giving it a glance. He plucked the silk hat from Fool's head, and the cold air squeezed suddenly at his pate, and Pinkerton reached into the hat and ran his fingers over the brim, slowly and methodically, and then he handed it back and nodded.
"I was surprised by your message," Fool said quietly, "but pleased that you would take up my offer."
"Don't be pleased yet."
Pinkerton inspected the walking stick.
"I carry no weapons, sir. I have always felt it takes a kind of courage to refuse a fight."
Pinkerton grimaced. There was a menace in the man he had not felt upon that first meeting.
"I never met a man who ran from a fight out of courage," he said.
"You're an American?"
Fool buttoned up his overcoat. He took the walking stick back and weighed it in his hands, then looked up at the bigger man.
"I was raised there." "Raised where?"
"Ah, not in Chicago, sir."
Fool smiled the cautious smile to see the stillness creep across the man's features.
"Come now," he said. "You're a public figure. You must expect me to know some few things about you."
"While I know nothing of you."
"That," Fool said, "I find difficult to believe."
Pinkerton lifted his face and Fool stood in silence, and after a moment he heard the quiet, slow footsteps of a constable walking his beat. When he was gone, Pinkerton said,
"You aren't American by birth."
Fool said nothing. He was reminding himself with impatience that this man could prove both his accomplice and his undoing. Dangerous, fiery, ill-tempered, violent.
"And you do not come from wealth?"
Pinkerton continued. He had removed his gloves to search Fool and had held them in his teeth as he did so, and now he pulled them back tightly over his wrists and flexed his fingers as he spoke. He said,
"You're too careful in your dress and your manners. You're too aware.
Ah,
there's no shame in being a self-made man."
Fool had so often stated the same that he wondered a moment just how thorough the detective's research might have been. He said,
"Once when I was a boy in the schoolhouse, I traded my only 2 pennies for a single brand new penny. When I brought it home, my father beat me for my stupidity."
Fool tugged at his whiskers.
"Everyone's attracted to the shinier thing.
especially if they don't know its real worth. When I grew older, I determined to make of myself a brighter and more attractive spectacle. Fool glanced at the sky as if to determine the hour. It was black and starless. He said he was a cobbler. Respectable, until debts got the better of him and drink did the rest. He studied Pinkerton to gauge the effect of his lie. What's any father like, really? You love them and you resist them and you want something from them that in the end they fail to give. Fool started to turn away, but then paused. He met the detective's eye. I was sorry to hear about yours, he said. There was a tension in the detective's shoulders, a ferocity in his stillness. He said nothing. In the Civil War, Fool had stood once beside Alan Pinkerton in a crowded army mess tent, while a hot rain gattled the tarps and chewed up the mud outside, and he had slid one shifty eye to gauge the man, drenched and snorting beside him. He was not tall, but there was a solidity to him that reminded Fool of the men who had once been engaged to saw down and drag clear a stand of timber from the Shade Estates. His wrists were strong, hairy. He flared his nostrils and spat and ran an open hand over his beard to crush the rain from it. His blues were steaming and hung heavily on him, like a horse blanket. Drones everything but the damned black flies. He grinned at the cook ladling out their mess, and his voice sounded like the soft, bird voice of a shopkeeper. Friendly, brisk, freighted in its friendliness with its own wants. All this Fool had observed with the quick eye of a boy from the streets, but when Alan Pinkerton turned his broad face and stared down at Fool, the man's eyes terrified him. Deep, lightless, the eyes of a dead man who did not yet know he was dead. What he saw now when he looked at the sun was a distortion of that father, a marred reflection, a twisting and warping of a great man gone wrong. The detective led him north out of the square up Regent Street, then turned east on Coventry, keeping to the crowds, until they had reached the green of Leicester Square. Two rent boys strolled arm in arm towards them in magenta neckties and green and cream overcoats, but upon seeing Pinkerton's face, the young men ceased their whistling and veered to the left and kept on. There were other men lounging under the solitary gas lamps waiting for some encounter, and the detective led him past to a small round building at the limits of a far hedge. It was fitted with a low, child-sized door, and he glanced around him, then withdrew a bent wire and picked the lock. A rancid air rushed past. He was standing just behind the detective's shoulder, and he could feel the man's physical power, but he did not flinch. Inside he glimpsed stairs, descending into shadow. "We're not entering by the river." Pinkerton was silent a long moment, and then he said, "Charlotte didn't die in the river." On a hook to the left of the door, Pinkerton found a lantern, and on a plaster shelf above it, the sparking flint, and these he took down. They were covered in a grime of dust. He turned his back and unhooked the glass door to check the tallow candle within. Then he crouched and held the bell of the flintwork over the wick, and scraped twice, and watched the wick catch and waver, and lean violently to one side and then burn tall. "You have a map, I presume," Fool said. "You must have instructions." Pinkerton gave him a long, slow, searching look, the lantern casting his features in eerie relief. "I met with an old friend of yours the other day," he said. "Martin Reckitt." Fool paused. "About Charlotte?" "Among other matters. He said you and I had much to talk about." Fool could feel a hardness in his throat. "Mr. Reckitt was always a capable man," he said with forced calm. "Perhaps not the most reliable. I have found it best to take his accounts on caution." "Yes. We were never friends." The detective inclined his head. "Associates, then." Fool wondered just what Martin Reckitt might have said to the man. He did not believe Reckitt knew his most damaging secrets, but then the aging thief was nothing if not resourceful. He said, "You have two fists, Mr. Pinkerton, like any peeler, but connecting them is a skull with a brain in it. That is more rare. I'd suggest you exercise that intelligence carefully when dealing with a man like Martin Reckitt. The Yard never managed to." "You don't have much faith in the Yard.
I prefer American defectives. Pinkerton lifted the lantern and the light caught the craggy planes of his face, distorted and grey-skinned and stern. Beneath his dour moustache he was smiling. My brother insists there's no such thing as bad press. Only bad printing. Pinkerton grunted, his smile fading. Come, he said. He doffed his hat to clear the lintel and stepped with a shiver through. Let us go find your mudlark, Mr. Fool. The stairs were dry. He paused on the third step and took the lantern from Pinkerton that he might shoulder the door more firmly shut, and it screeched to with a clatter that echoed deep below them. Then the American took the lantern back and continued on past. They wound their way down into darkness. A weak corona of light cast over the stone walls, the spidering cracks lit in the ancient bricks, their wet footprints trailing behind them like some doomed path the cyclist might once have walked. The air tasted of dust and iron. The stairs ended in a worm-eaten wood door, and Fool reached out and tried the handle, and his hand came away wet. The door did not give. Pinkerton pressed past, set his shoulder to. The door punched wide with a loud shriek, and he staggered through. It was a long arched corridor, and Pinkerton paused only a moment, then turned right and walked quickly over the ill-fitted stones. Water in the cracks, water shimmering like mercury at the edges of the lightfall. There were streaks of black moss growing on the walls where moisture trickled. At every 20 yards or so, an alcove opened to their right, and each alcove was barred by an iron gate, and he could see Pinkerton eyeing each, but neither man spoke, and they went on. The corridor curved, branched, curved again, and Pinkerton kept to the left until it began very gradually to slope downward. At last they came to a three-way fork, and the American paused and walked back some 10 feet until he reached the nearest alcove, and when he set his hand on the gate there, it opened with a rattle, and he hoisted the lantern and peered in. Fool followed. Within he could see another set of stairs. We're not there yet, Pinkerton murmured. They went in. Fool could hear the slow roar of running water as they descended. The smell thickened. The air went tarry and rank. The second stairwell was steep and slick, and Fool set a hand on the slimed wall as he went, holding his walking stick in his fist for balance. He knew men had been lost in the lines, knew to avoid the smaller branches where the air was bad and choke damp could strike. The night before, the gunsmith's apprentice had stood in the emporium office, anxiously turning his hat in his bitten fingers as he delivered the detective's message. Flood had listened, glowering. He had stormed out in disgust, and then come right back in, and the two of them had talked through it. Fool said he would be careful. Flood warned him the tide would rise 5 hours after midnight, and careful was not enough, and that he would need to be above it by then. Fool said Pinkerton could have no reason to let him come to harm. Flood said Pinkerton was a bastard, and a man of violence, and harm was like breathing to him. And if you get yourself lost, his friend growled, don't stop to think about it. Follow the waters out. Down there, Rat's been known to eat a man to the bone and him still alive, and Rat's ain't the worst of what's down there. All this Fool was thinking as he followed the huge shadowy figure of the detective. They came out, at last, upon the white parapet of the London sewers. Pinkerton lifted the lantern high, coins of light on the dark waters before them, a vast arched ceiling vanishing into blackness. In one hand he had withdrawn a map and unfolded it deftly with his thumb and two fingers, and he held it up in the light. He looked left, looked right, studied the map again. Fool watched him. Lost already? Pinkerton smiled grimly. Not just yet, he said. They tied handkerchiefs at their noses and mouths like bandits, and went on in silence under a penumbra of light, and as they walked, Fool felt a kind of dread coming up in him. He strained over the rush of the waters to hear any cry or rustle of men with murder in their hearts. He knew if the berserkers came upon them, it would be sudden and swift and brutal. The parapet was wide enough to walk abreast, and Fool moved with hands at his sides, and his walking stick gripped fast, and he could hear the big American breathing fiercely through his nostrils alongside him. After a distance, Pinkerton slowed, held a hand out to stop. He shuttered the lantern to a slit, and they stood, listening. The low rumble of the waters. Fool's blood loud in his ears. He could hear nothing else.
"What is it?"
he whispered, his handkerchief shirring. Pinkerton unshuttered the lantern, their shadows sliding up the curved wall. But then it came again, a weird, distant hooting, like the call of a night creature. The cry filled the tunnel, elongating and distorting as it sounded, and Fool shivered to hear it. He could not tell from which direction it came, ahead or behind.
"What the hell is it?"
Pinkerton whispered through his handkerchief. Fool listened. It did not sound human. Pinkerton walked to the wall, made a deliberate mark in chalk.
"Let's keep moving," he said.
It was a wide tunnel, high and well ventilated, and the waters moved at a steady drift, muscling past, scraping the filth and detritus of a world city against its bed. The corpses of dogs, cats, rats, washed down from the slaughterhouses, even the coiled, tumbling entrails of horses turning end over end in its current. The cavern veered left, and then left again, and then a smaller branch sewer opened on the far side, but Pinkerton kept on. The chamber widened until it seemed a kind of reservoir of muck, and the stink deepened into something older, thicker, a stench they had to wade through as they went. Punctured here and there, high up in the walls, were the narrow, clotted outfalls of old sewer lines, a steady trickle of crud leaking from their openings into the reservoir. When Pinkerton lifted the lantern, Fool could see, suspended from the ceiling, long spindled stalactites of putrid matter hanging over the waters, and he glanced at Pinkerton, and the skin around the man's eyes was drawn and pinched in the strange light, but he kept slowly on. After a time, there was a sound from the far side of the chamber, and then a light appeared, a luminescence hovering, moving bumpily forward in the darkness. Pinkerton stiffened, shuttering his lantern too late. Fool heard the click of his revolver. A second light appeared, more distant. A third. And then Fool saw the dim outline of a man take form. He had tied to his front a small bull's-eye lantern, and the half-shuttered light crossed and crossed again in the gloom as he went, wraith-like, about his business. The man was back-bent, and his arms were long, and he did not look their way, though Fool knew they must be visible. Instead, he passed silently on, in a long, greasy, velveteen coat, pockets weighed heavily down, a sack clinking over his shoulder. Then a second man appeared wearing a canvas apron stained with what looked like blood, and this man carried a long staff with some sort of flattened blade at its end, like a monstrous hoe, and he walked with his bald head bare, and his grey skin gleaming in the weak light. There were three of them in all, moving single file in some strange procession, and as the third passed, he raised a forlorn hand as if in warning or entreaty, and his face was cadaverous and terrible. Then he too was lost to view in a gloom beyond which it was not possible to go, and the two of them stood again alone.
"Tunnel men," Fool breathed in relief. "Salvagers."
Pinkerton looked at him gravely. They went on. After a short length, they heard a steady scraping, and then saw, tied to the parapet on the far side, a skeletal hull rising and falling in the waters. It was an old Peter boat, fitted out for dredging at one time, but now pitched and pared for nothing beyond shore work. It had no stern, no aft, but a sharp cutwater at either end, the bow scarred from grapples hooked there years past. It rode shallow in the current. All this they saw at a glance, and Fool knew it would belong to the salvagers they had just seen. Pinkerton studied it uneasily from the edge of the walkway, the foul waters between, his handkerchief sucking in around his mouth at each breath, sucking, then billowing back out.
"Careful," Fool murmured. "That's more than deep enough to drown in."
Pinkerton regarded him with unreadable eyes, then consulted the map and made his mark in chalk. It was then they heard that eerie cry come again, closer this time, distinctly anguished. Fool stared in alarm at the big American, and neither spoke as the cry swelled past them and dissipated. Then came a second cry, a response. This sounded higher, nearer, and Fool could make out the long, slow bending of the vowels as it replied.
"Did it just say clear?"
Pinkerton hissed.
"No,"
Fool whispered.
"It said here."
The cry came again, louder. Pinkerton raised his face to the darkness behind them, and then Fool, too, heard it. Footsteps clattering towards them. It sounded like a great horde of men running. Fool twisted in alarm.
"This way,"
he said, but Pinkerton was already running. Fool could hear the low hooting cry past them, and the clatter and chink of what sounded like chains, and he too was running fast, his walking stick low at his side. Pinkerton just ahead with the lantern swaying wildly, and casting the tunnel and the rushing waters into bizarre spirals of shadow, spirals of light. His hat flew from his head, spun out across the gap, and landed upright and adrift in the black currents and was gone. He did not slow. That chamber came to an end at three wide sewers, each line opening at an angle, and Pinkerton paused, breathing heavily. He set down the lantern and unfolded his map. Fool could hear the clatter of feet behind them.
"Pick one,"
he snapped. Pinkerton squinted at the map. An ancient brick walkway had been erected across to the center line, overspilling now with sewage. It reached a span of 9 feet at least, the wash of foul matter making the crossing treacherous. Fool stared, gauging it. Then he picked up the lantern and looked at Pinkerton, and turned and ran nimbly across. The going was slick and dangerous, and when he was in the clear he turned and set the lantern down at his feet and held out a hand to Pinkerton. The detective glanced uneasily behind him. Fool saw he had his revolver low at his thigh.
"Don't think about it. Just come."
Fool could see for a moment his companion plunging into the murk and being dragged under, and then he put it from his mind. It was not what he wanted. The detective had pulled the handkerchief down from his face and was glaring at the narrow brick walkway.
"God damn it,"
he muttered. Then he turned and strode back into the darkness and disappeared. Fool called out to him in a loud whisper, but there was no answer. He heard quick footsteps, and all at once the detective emerged from the shadows, hurtling towards him at speed, and then he was leaping with his arms outstretched and legs wide. He seemed to hang an impossible long moment in the air before his right foot came down, hard, on the edge of the old brick crossing, and the bricks crumbled and gave way. Then Pinkerton was rolling like a fallen horse into Fool, and the two men crashed against the wall at their backs. There was an eerie sucking sound from beside them, and then a strong current of filth poured through the breach in the bricks and into the tunnel below. Fool could hear men shouting behind them, and then he was scrambling to his knees, and Pinkerton was shattering the lantern, and they both were crawling blind around the corner into the line, and they lay with legs outstretched, trying not to breathe, and listening as the figures rushed past. Tunnels and turnings. Lightlessness. When the walls had again fallen silent, Pinkerton got to his feet, shook out his pant leg. The smell was terrible. Then he unshuttered the lantern and Fool stood and they went on. Some of the lines were dry, wide, others deep and ancient. In great submerged caverns they crept high on the walls across narrow catwalks of rotting wood, the lantern guttering between them. Pinkerton would pause and study the map and then go again on. They found themselves in an older sewer line, and it narrowed as they went, until they were stooped and walking slowly. The ancient bricks had rotted over the decades and given way, and there were huge glistening lumps of matter deposited in the breaches. Vegetable peelings, the drainings from stables and streets, rotten mortar, wood softened and trailing rags of muck, even the outlines of kettles and pans and stoneware jugs, all the one color and glued together. At one turning, Pinkerton lifted the lantern and a huge black rat crossed the spill of light and moved up the tunnel. Then a second appeared, and a third, and all at once there was a sound of rushing air, and the far wall became a roiling mass of rats pouring past, a river of darkness, and they stood unbreathing as the rats flooded past and were gone. Pinkerton ran a grimy hand across his forehead, streaking it.
"Wait,"
Fool said, panting. The air was bad, his breathing shallow.
"Stop. Wait.
We're nearly there,"